This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a splendid weekend and are getting ready for a fabulous Thanksgiving. And our number, as always, is toll-free wherever you are, 877-217-5757. You can dial locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Smiley Gray Anders Jr. is with us. If you read his column, he's on vacation, soon to be returning, and for good reason. He's celebrating a big birthday, born on this date in 1937. Good morning, Smiley Anders.
Oh, good morning, Jim. So nice of you to call.
Well, it's good to hear your voice on a special day. 38 years writing the column, which means it's been almost half your life doing this thing.
Oh, that's right. It feels like all my life sometimes. I enjoy it. Oh, there's no heavy lifting. And, they put up with me at the Advocate, which I really appreciate.
I was talking to a journalist in this city a few days ago, and he said that he thought that more people read the newspaper for your column than for anything else.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I'll take all the credit for our circulation. I assume I'll get a big raise for that, too. So.
Well, you and the lovely Lady Catherine, I'm sure, are celebrating this special day. As I mentioned, you were born on this date in 1937 in Natchez, Mississippi. I tell you what, Smiley, you have stayed the course for a man who, as we know, has burned the candle at both ends.
Yeah, I would have taken better care of myself if I'd known I was going to live so long.
What will you and the family be doing today?
Well, we just got in. We had a Gulf Coast vacation down in Orange Beach. My daughter and son-in-law joined us. They live in Long Beach, Mississippi, so it wouldn't too far for them. So that was kind of our big celebration. I'm thinking Lady K is going to take me out to dinner tonight. So that's kind of my – I've been hitting around, so I think maybe she's gotten the hint, you know. So
Well, Smiley is a man of the town and about town, and you have your spots. We read about them, and some of them, of course, are five-star restaurants and others are not, but you're a man of the people, Smiley.
Generally, I like to go places that have been here 30 years or more, you know, the pastime, Flutely, that kind of stuff. So, Pool Boy Lords, you know, those are my hangouts.
Chris's Steakhouse. That might be a good...
Yes. Yes, that too.
All right. Well, 877-217-5757 is your number if you'd like to wish Smiley Anders a happy birthday. If you turn to Section B of the Advocate every day, Monday through Saturday, you're going to see Smiley's face and column on the front page. And today he is on vacation. And I like the way they put it when you're on vacation. It says Smiley Anders is on vacation. His column will return when he does.
And it's kind of open-ended, so if I decide not to come back or die or something, you know, they'll be covered on that, you know. Well, he never came back, you know, so that's it. So, I will be coming in into the office tomorrow, and I'll have a Wednesday column. Then I do my Thanksgiving column, which I do every year, where I just kind of wrap up things that have happened with my kids and grandkids and my brother's family. It's just my brother and I, mm-hmm. His kids and grandkids, and so we just kind of wrap that up. People seem to like to read about it for some reason. These are people they don't know, but it's just mm-hmm. what's happened in their life, you know, having babies and that kind of stuff.
Well,
that's what I'm thankful for.
You have the kind of a column that in the old newspaper days was a staple in many cities, but there aren't many who do what you do in the country. In fact, you kept winning so many national awards that they discontinued the Herb Cain Award because of you.
Yeah, they had an items category, and I won it about five times. It was kind of embarrassing. And so they, the next thing I know, they've done away with the category. They never told me why, but I like to think immodestly that it was because I kept winning the thing. I don't
know. So, well, maybe someday they will reopen it as the Smiley Gray Anders Jr. Award. A listener asked.
You know, I heard from.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Smiley. Go ahead.
I heard from Jamie Wax the other day. It's a great guy, and he said I had the first social media. I had actually started social media, and I said, well, if I did that, I should be as rich as Zuckerberg by now. But that hasn't happened yet. But I guess it's almost like a blog where you just. You know, everybody shares in it, you know, so it's kind
of
fun.
I don't think there's any question you've got something special, and it can't be replicated. And when you're gone, I don't know of anybody who will be able to take the place of one Smiley Gray Anders Jr. How old were you? Laurie asked this. How old were you when you moved to Baton Rouge?
I was 8. So, went to Struma High. We moved to North Baton Rouge, and it was right after the war. And my dad had gotten out of the service, and he was with Swifton Company, the meat company, and he was transferred here. And, you know, coming from Natchez, we thought, boy, this is a big city. Uh-huh. I remember they had 5 digits on the telephone. We only had 3 in Natchez. And I was thinking, my gosh,
wow.
What an enormous place.
5 digits.
They had things called cocktail lounges that we didn't have in Natchez. I thought that was so exotic. You know, what a great urban metropolis this was.
877-217-5757 for Smiley Gray Anders Jr. celebrating birthday number. Can I say the number, Smiley?
Sure, absolutely.
Number 80 today. That was Doug Morrow's number when he was starring for the Tigers. Andy Hamilton wore it too. Peggy and Broadmoor. Peggy, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Happy birthday, Smiley. I'm listening to it in the car, getting ready to go pick up Chesley and head to New Orleans for a meeting for the film festival. But I was listening, and I was like, I got to call in and say hi to Smiley and Jim and wish you a big happy birthday.
Well, thank you so much, and drive carefully.
And I think you should go to Ruth Chris. That's been around a long time.
I might wind up there. Who knows?
She needs to, like, throw in the big bucks tonight. You deserve it. That's mm-hmm. a big birthday.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah, so maybe people can call in with a suggestion for Smiley. He's been around a long time, and he was here before he started writing the Daily Column, and thank you, Peggy, for calling. But we've noted that when the president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was killed, 54 years ago this week, November 22nd, 1963, Smiley was working at the Farm Bureau, which was on Airline Highway then and is now. And after work, of course, the country was in mourning. You went and kicked back at an old place on North 19th Street called Chris's Bar.
Yeah. I remember I was on your show one time, and we had a contest, name the bar, and finally, after a lot of guesses, somebody finally came up with it, because it's been gone a long time now, but it was a hangout, downtown neighborhood hangout, and a lot of my friends joined me. We didn't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. We just kind of gathered there and watched black and white TV and had a fishbowl of beer.
Yeah, fishbowl. I remember in college I used to drink those, and it didn't take many fishbowls to feel the hurt.
You have to use both hands. Yeah.
Another listener asked Smiley where you grew up. I would imagine it was in North Baton Rouge.
Yeah, it was Sherwood Drive, which is not to be confused with Sherwood Forest, and it's between Pike Road and Seneca Highway, and not far from Exxon. And almost everybody in our neighborhood, the guys work for one of the plants, and they rode their bikes to work. A lot of them did, with hard hats. And I could see those guys with khakis and hard. And I think Exxon issued bicycles because they all had, like, these yellow bikes with baskets on them, had their lunch in them, and they would ride the bike to work. It was only probably a mile or two or so.
Wow. And you went to Broadmoor. Excuse me, you didn't go to Broadmoor. You went to Struma.
Don't say that. No,
I'm sorry to insult you, but you went to you went to Struma High School, which at that time was the place to go.
Oh, it was a huge. Well, at that time there was no Glen Oaks, Broadmoor, Lee, any of those. It was us and Baton Rouge High was about it as far as public big public high schools. And, of course, you can imagine the rivalry between Baton Rouge High and Estruma, you know, North versus South.
And, of course, your high school chum and later your college classmate was one Billy Ab Cannon.
Yeah, I had one class with Billy. He's a bright kid. I used to sit behind him and copy off of it. I don't think he ever knew that, but he was a really smart kid.
And he turned number 80 on August 2nd. So you and Billy have a lot in common. And, of course, we're about to take a break. But when we come back, we'll talk about Smiley's genesis in journalism. And it all began on that Halloween night of 1959. Smiley Gray Anders was reporting when Billy Cannon thrilled the masses and executed the greatest play in LSU football history. We'll be back with Smiley after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. And Smiley Gray Anders Jr. is with us, celebrating his birthday today. Born on this date in Natchez in 1937, moved to Baton Rouge 1945, and has been here most of that time since. And it has been quite a voyage. With 38 of the years, the last 38, he has written a daily column for The Advocate. And before we go back to the phone lines, once again, your number, 877-217-5757. Smiley, you've told the story before, but it's worth mentioning again. Your high school teammate or classmate at Estruma, Billy Cannon, 1959, returns the kick to beat Ole Miss, 89 yards, 7-3 LSU wins, and you were on the field as a reporter. What happened that night?
Yes, I was on the sideline. I was a graduate student at that time, and I had a job spotting for United Press International as photographer, which is a wire service like Associated Press. I don't think it's around anymore. But we were down on the sidelines. It was late in the game, and we happened to be on the Ole Miss side of the field because at that point it looked like Ole Miss was going to win 3-0, and he wanted to get some color shots of the Ole Miss crowd. At that time, they waved Confederate flags. And so we were there. I happened to be on the Ole Miss sideline. And, you know, there was a punt. The game had been just, you can imagine, it was just a defensive struggle. Just a routine punt. And Billy catches the ball and takes off running and runs right by us because we happened to be on the right side of the field. Came down and started shedding tackles. And after he shed one, we thought, well, they're gonna stop him there, and they, of course, they never did. They just dropped off of him like he was made of Teflon or something, and he runs down. And I was so excited. I was supposed to tell the photographer what the how long he ran, and I missed it. I said it was 82 yards because ground level it's kind of hard to see the markers there, so. Luckily, somebody at the UPI office in Dallas, when we sent the photo, corrected it. So I didn't have a classic error there, but because it was pretty exciting. And I kind of dropped my journalistic objectivity at that point, I'm afraid.
Hippolyte Landry, Dr. Hippolyte Landry, calling in. You're on the air with Smiley Anders. Hi, Hippolyte.
Oh. Well, hi, Doc. Is he there?
Yeah, he's playing a song for you.
Oh my gosh, I'm honored.
Happy birthday, Smiley.
What was it on the kazoo?
I thought a little harmonica player would wake everybody up this morning.
The harmonica. Harmonica.
Yeah, oh, I thought it was a kazoo. I wasn't sure. Yeah,
no, that was my harmonica.
I wrote about Doc a while back. He took a solo flight around the world, which is kind of an incredible thing to even imagine. And did it just for the heck of it, I think. Just
when you think about
all the way
it,
around the world,
outside the loop in a bonanza.
Somebody said,
an outside the loop, because you can't loop a bonanza even inside. But when you go around the world, that's an outside loop. So it was an outside 3,000-mile loop.
Well, Dr. Landry, you've known Smiley a long time.
Oh, boy, he's a great guy. I started to say I'm going to miss him, but he's not going anywhere, but I miss him now. I don't see him at the pastime anymore. So I used to see him.
Yeah, you can wait a while to miss me. I'm in no rush for you to miss me, believe me.
And, Jim, it's so good to talk to you. You do such a great show, and thank you for having all your great guests. And, Smiley, you're the top of the line. We love you, buddy.
All right.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you so much, Doc.
Our former coroner. Now, a listener asks about some restaurants that have gone by the wayside in Baton Rouge. The Brunswick. You remember the Brunswick? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was
Italian
one of
Gardens on Convention Street.
Giamanco's?
I guess the Village. The old Village. They still have a couple of little villages, which are great restaurants, as a matter of fact. But the old Village on Airline. And what they used to call the Traffic Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Saban's, my gosh, that was a great, great steakhouse.
And this is Tom asking about Giamanco's on Government Street. You went there on occasion.
Oh, the wonderful oyster place. Yeah, that was our go-to place for oysters and raw oysters. And they had wonderful Italian food. That was my daddy's favorite mm-hmm. part. He was friends with Charlie Giamanco and... of course, he was in the meat business, and they used to sell him, stuff and go there all the time. He was one of his first customers in Baton Rouge. Right after the war, when we moved here, I think Charlie was just opening it. Great place.
When you grew up, the Piccadilly downtown was kind of the epicenter, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. We went to St. James and the 11 o'clock service, so we would get out at noon, which is when all the other churches got out, the Baptist Church, the Presbyterian, the Methodist, the Catholic, up the street. And we would always all converge on the Piccadilly to have lunch. And we would always get real antsy when it got to be around 12 and the service was still going on. But we would usually beat the Baptist because that's one thing about the Episcopal Church. We don't have long sermons. And so we would get there, maybe 10 minutes ahead of the Baptist down the street, and we'd always be in line when they got there. And then sometimes the Catholics would beat us, but they were a little further up the street.
Well, Smiley, it is quite an honor to have you spend your birthday with us. And
I am so delighted you called. It really just made my day.
Well, we'll talk later today, but Smiley Anders, thanks for staying the course and blessing us with your talent for all these years.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
And happy birthday to you, my friend.
Oh, thanks.
See you soon, as in very soon.
Okay.
Take care, my friend.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Good.
Bye-bye. And a few housekeeping measures. 12.5% of the people voted in Saturday's election in Louisiana. It actually was a little above the forecast from Tom Shedler, as Secretary of State. But in the end, John Schroeder won by 43,000 votes. He defeated Derek Edwards, who spent almost no money. He did make an appearance on this show, and he received 44% of the vote, almost a record for an African-American candidate in a statewide election in Louisiana. Kip Holden did a bit better than that a few years ago against Billy Nungesser, but the new treasurer is John Schroeder, succeeding John Kennedy. Schroeder is a Republican from the St. Tammany area, an Army veteran, a graduate of Southeastern Louisiana University, and he was elected to the Louisiana House in 2007, same day that Governor John Bel Edwards was elected in a neighboring district. And now Schroeder, of course, will be most likely a critic of John Bel Edwards and anybody, anywhere, who advocates any kind of a tax. He is definitely an anti-tax hawk, and we'll follow John Schroeder and look forward to talking with him now as Treasurer Schroeder. In Baton Rouge, Judy Moore Vendetto won a city court race. She defeated Chris Hester in a close race, 465 votes separating those two, and so Judy Moore Vendetto, the sister of the district attorney, will now serve on the city court in East Baton Rouge Parish. Voters in East Baton Rouge Parish approved a two cent hotel occupancy tax that will enable the Raising Cane's River Center to be spruced up after 40 years and provide funding for Visit Baton Rouge to promote the city. Last year, a similar tax failed, but this time a 2% tax did succeed, 61 to 39%. In New Orleans, LaToya Cantrell is the new mayor, receiving 60% of the votes in her race against Desiree Charbonnet. She will succeed Mitch Landrieu next year, and LaToya Cantrell is an African-American female Democrat, like the mayors of Baton Rouge and Shreveport. So the state's three largest cities have African-American female Democrats at the helm. And the LSU Tigers won 30-10 over Tennessee in a monsoon in Knoxville. LSU's 8-3. The Tigers have won 8 games in a season now, 18 years in a row. And the Saints rallied to defeat the Redskins 34-31 in overtime. We're back with Tyler Bridges after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. Our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting with Tyler Bridges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who reports often for The Advocate, but the last few months he's been at Harvard as a fellow there, and he is now preparing a book about his alma mater, Stanford, and California, and a game in 1982 on this date, November 20th, which may have the most famous or infamous finish, depending on how you look at it, in the history of college football. Tyler Bridges, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
And I think you're joining us from California today.
I am indeed.
Well, this play, and it is called the play and the game, Stanford and California, occurred on this date 35 years ago. And it's amazing how much enthusiasm there was for the 1982 big game. Cal coming in with a 6-4 record, and Stanford was 5-5. It turned out to be the final game for John Elway, the great quarterback for Stanford, as a collegian. Why was there so much enthusiasm for the big game of 1982?
Yeah, the big game, Cal-Stanford, started in 1892. It's like one of those rivalries, Florida State, Auburn, Alabama, Ohio State, Michigan, Washington State. And the two schools are only about 30 miles apart, so a lot of the grads get to know each other. And it, at least at that time, it was the most important game of the regular season, with the hope of getting to a bowl game, because there weren't many bowl games in those days. And indeed, the game is known locally as the Big Game.
And you had just graduated from Stanford, correct?
Yeah, I had graduated from Stanford in June of 1982. And again, this is the old days. I listened to the game. That's all you could do, was listen to the game with Stanford and Cal fans at a boathouse in Washington, D.C.
There was not the cable option that we have today, in which you can watch almost any game you wish, but in those days it was more dramatic when you had to search to find the play-by-play, just as there was in 1959 when Billy Cannon had his famous run for LSU to defeat Ole Miss on Halloween night. The Cal announcer was a guy named Joe Starkey, a legendary broadcaster in the Bay Area, KGOAM 810. He called the game, and here's how he sounded on this date, 35 years ago, the big game between Stanford and California. Stanford has just taken a 20-19 lead, and it was an amazing drive by John Elway to pull off this accomplishment, and there was just one play left, the kickoff.
Yeah, and if I could point out what helped make it so dramatic in the big game of 1982 was Stanford was down on their own 13-yard line, 4th and 17, with Elway as the quarterback. It looked like it was hopeless, but he completed a 29-yard pass for a first down, and all of a sudden Stanford had the hopes alive, and so Stanford kicked a field goal. Elway called timeout with 8 seconds left, time for the field goal, and then one other play. And so Stanford kicked the field goal to go ahead 20-19, and all that was left was the kickoff. And if I can jump in also, Jim, so I'm listening to this game with my buddies It's from Stanford at this boathouse in Washington. And when Stanford kicked the field goal, there's a traditional yell you do it for Stanford against Cal. And we did that yell, and then we left. We had won the game.
Well, here's the kickoff from Joe Starkey of KGOAM 810 Radio, the voice of the Cal Bears.
Harmon will probably try to squib it, and he does. Ball comes loose, and the Bears have to get out of bounds. Rogers along the sideline, another one. They're still in deep trouble at midfield. They tried to do a couple of... The ball is still loose as they get it to Rogers. They give it back now to the 30. They're down to the 20. Oh, the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone. He's going into the end zone. Will it count? The Bears have scored, but the bands are out on the field. There were flags all over the place. Wait and see what happens. We don't know who won the game. There are flags on the field. We have to see whether or not the flags are against Stanford or Cal. The Bears may have made some illegal laterals. It could be that it won't count. The Bears, believe it or not, took it all the way into the end zone. If the penalty is against Stanford, California would win the game. If it is not, the game is over and Stanford has won. We've heard no decision yet. Everybody's milling around on the field. The Bears have won! Oh, my God! The most amazing, sensational, dramatic, heartrending, exciting, thrilling finish in the history of college football. California has won the big game over Stanford. Oh, excuse me for my voice, but I have never, never seen anything like it in the history of I've ever seen any game in my life. The Bears have won it.
All right. That's a dagger right to the heart of any Stanford fan, isn't it? For even today, I imagine it ticks you off when you hear it, Tyler Bridges.
Well, any Stanford fan will tell you that during one of the laterals that one of the Cal players' knees was down, and that later the final lateral was actually forward, but when the Cal player's knee was down, that's what caused players, the members of the Stanford band who were gathered on the sideline to do their post-game concert and celebrate this amazing victory led by Elway. So they rushed out onto the field thinking the game was over, only it wasn't. And I literally interviewed a player from Stanford yesterday because of this book that I'm writing. He ran out onto the field, too, and he showed me the video of where he was as the play went rushing by him. And when it was declared that Cal had won the game, the winner of the big game, Cal-Stanford, gets what's called the Stanford Axe. And Stanford had to turn over the axe that year to Cal because the winner gets to keep the axe. And on the campus at Stanford, where they keep the axe, for the next year, they put a giant screw.
Well, Sports Illustrated, as part of a 12-page article, reviewed the play and found no mistakes in officiating. It sounds like you disagree with that.
Well, I'm representing really the Stanford point of view. People, again, Stanford fans clearly think that the one point the ball carrier was down. But the players were very bitter. Fans were very bitter for a long time. I interviewed John Elway a couple of years ago for a magazine piece I wrote. And by now, he was beginning to make jokes. You know, the play ends with the Cal player rushing into the end zone and bowling over. A trombone player, his name is Gary Terrell. In fact, I was with Gary yesterday, and the Elway, when I interviewed him a couple of years ago, he said, what would have happened if the trombone player tackled him at the two-yard line?
That would have been something. They would have had to make a decision, yeah. Well, this guy, Gary Terrell, he appeared on The Tonight Show, didn't he?
Yeah, he had his 15 minutes of fame. His trombone that he was carrying when the Cal player ran into him in the end zone, that is now in the College Hall of Fame. And there's a lot of pranks back and forth between Cal and Stanford. Over the years, he tried to steal the axe, whichever other side has it. But Gary was telling me that several months later, just a few months after the game, apparently there were Cal fans came in and stole his trombone because he came into his room one night. And nothing was gone except the trombone, and the window was open. But Gary had two trombones, and they didn't get the one that he was carrying during the play. So that one, again, now is in the College Hall of Fame.
Well, the quarterback for Stanford was John Elway, and he had had a big season, really a great player on a so-so team. And because of the loss, Stanford did not go to a bowl game, and it was the last game for him. How did he remember the end of the game?
Well, he was very, years in the past, he would do interviews. He was very angry and bitter because, as he said, he never went to a bowl game. They were going to go to the Hall of Fame game. In those days, as I mentioned, there weren't that many bowl games, so to go was a big deal, and everybody was really wanting to make sure that Elway, who was the number one player in the country in terms of where he was going to go in the draft, the most heralded player, that he would go to at least one bowl game in his time at Stanford, that the team would have a winning record, and also that he would win the Heisman. And so Stanford just fell very short because of again, what's known as the play. And so Elway didn't get the bowl game, and the team didn't get the bowl game, and Elway finished second in the Heisman to Herschel Walker. But obviously Elway went on to a pretty successful career after that.
Yes, indeed. Now, many of these guys went on to successful careers in other walks of life, as you would expect for graduates of Cal and Stanford, and I would imagine you've talked with some of them.
Yeah, again, there was a lot of anger and bitterness that the Stanford players trashed the locker room, in the immediate aftermath of a game that they thought had been stolen from them. But now everybody has made peace with it, and that probably for every single player in that game, maybe other than John Elway, it was probably the most important game or most noteworthy, memorable game of their lives. And so even the Stanford players that I'm talking to remember the game with a certain fondness just because of the notoriety. Although, again, I think if they had won, that would have been great. They would have gone to a bowl game, but no one really, not many people would have remembered the game, but now everybody remembers it.
We'll talk some more with Tyler Bridges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has spent many years, most of his career in Louisiana, and we'll talk with him about some matters here. Well, by the way, last week was the 26th anniversary of the race from hell between Edwin Edwards and David Duke, and Tyler wrote the definitive book about David Duke, The Rise of David Duke, and I think The Rise and Fall of David Duke is coming soon as well from Tyler. But we'll talk with him about that and what's going on with Governor John Bel Edwards facing re-election in a couple of years. But some more thoughts about the play and the game of 1982, 35 years ago today, back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Ali Baltazar is producing, and our guest for a little while longer is Tyler Bridges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who covers things in Louisiana. But one of his passions is obviously his alma mater, and he's back in California right now for a little while, getting information and interviews together for a book that he is preparing about the game, the play that was November 20th, 1982, Stanford, California. Cal scores on the final play of the game on a touchdown with several laterals, controversial finish, the Stanford band on the field, crazy finish. Pontiac, by the way, has announced that game as the ultimate high-performance play of the NCAA, crowning the play as NCAA football's most memorable moment of all time. 877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Tyler Bridges. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I think it was a year or two before the Cal game that Tulane played Stanford. I was stationed at Vandenberg at the time and went up there. Didn't Stanford have an All-American end, Ken Magnuson or some such name at the time?
James Lofton, too, a future Pro Football Hall of Famer. They did have what was his, you remember the receiver, Margarine, was that his name?
Well, there were several. There was a guy named Kenny Marjoram who won onto the pros. Andre Tyler was another, and James Lofton. But that game, and I think Dan's talking about, was Stanford-Tulane at the Superdome in 1979, and that was the first game that John Elway played for Stanford. He was a freshman, and Tulane just whacked Stanford.
And Tulane that year had a very good team. They beat LSU as well. And Rock Huntus was the quarterback. Now, Dr. Rock Huntus. And Dan, I think you have outed yourself as a graduate of Tulane University. All those years that I never knew.
I don't talk about it too much in this town.
Well, well, thank you, Dan. The 79 Greenies were pretty good, and the coach was Larry Smith. Now, the coach of Cal was a guy named Joe Capp. Joe Capp, the quarterback who had led the Minnesota Vikings to a Super Bowl, a really eccentric fella. And his comment after the game of 1982 was, "The Bear would not quit. The Bear would not die." Capp took a lot of headshots in his career. I don't know how much is left, and I'm not being facetious about this. Like many players of his vintage, this guy, as we know, he played quarterback like a linebacker. But have you captured the quotes from Joe Capp in reflection about this game, Tyler Bridges?
Yeah, and I'll point out that Joe Capp was a graduate of his alma mater, Cal, and in the last time that Cal went to the Rose Bowl, which is a big deal in California and the West Coast, Joe Capp was the quarterback, and then he went off to a career in the Canadian Football League before signing with the Vikings, and as you said, leading them to a Super Bowl in 1969. And I'm reaching out to Joe Capp. I think he actually is not in great shape in terms of his health, but I do hope to get together with him because I am, he's one of the guys I want to talk to for my book that'll be on the play.
And the coach for Stanford, I think, was Paul Wiggin, and he was kind of a crew-cut guy, not the kind of guy you would think who would be the coach for Stanford, but is he still around?
Yeah, he works for the Minnesota Vikings. I believe he's 83 years old, and like Cap, he was coaching his alma mater. And what happened was that was Wiggin's third year as coach at Stanford, you know, kind of mediocre record. And what happened in the play just seemed to take the life out of Stanford. The next year, Stanford went 1-10, and Wiggin was fired. And the players that I've talked to said that just the dramatic loss in the 1982 big game just took the wind out of the sails of the Stanford team for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Well, 75,662 were on hand, and I'm sure that number has increased of people who say they were there. And it is significant because this game meant absolutely nothing other than Stanford getting a bowl bid if the Cardinal won. And yet the enthusiasm was intense, and I don't know that we have that kind of passion, and it may be because every game is on television. And the stadium was obviously full right to the very end of the game, Tyler.
Yeah, and they were playing. It was significant that they were playing at Cal Berkeley because the fans and the Stanford band could go onto the field. There was no fence in between the stands and the field, and that's one of the reasons why they all went out onto the field. But I have to say, I just went to the big game this past Saturday or 2 days ago in Palo Alto. And it's not even the last game of the season. For years and years, including in 1982, the big game, and I think this is true of all the big football rivalries, was the last regular season game, and you hope to go to a bowl game. But Stanford now this coming Saturday is going to play against Notre Dame, and I think something has been taken out of the rivalry. And I noticed that UCLA USC was also this past Saturday, mm-hmm. And I think this is all because of TV. Because of all the immense money that the universities want to make from TV. And I just believe it's a corrupting influence, the TV is. And I think it's a shame that these rivalries are being downgraded in the name of making more money. And ultimately, maybe some people won't like me saying this, Jim, but I think the most people who benefit are the people in the athletic department, the coaches, who are all making so much money now. And I think that something has been lost for the fans. And as you said, these games are on TV. You don't even know what time the game is going to be played until TV decides it the week before. And I think the fans who go to the games have lost something.
Well, and these games on radio, these schools pay huge, or they get huge rights fees to have their games broadcast. And let's face it, with all these games on television, There aren't as many people listening to the radio broadcasts as there were back in the day, and there's a book or two to be composed about the way the business of college football has changed. But I look forward to your account of the 1982 big game, and you've got all these peripheral stories that are so captivating, and of course, the fact that it was the final college game for one of the great players in the history of college football, John Elway. At that time, what was his sentiment as far as what occurred? And a listener notes that Elway's dad, you would know, Tyler, succeeded Paul Wiggin, is that correct, as head coach of Stanford?
I don't know if he succeeded right away. He may have, but Jack Elway was the coach of the San Jose State football team that Stanford played each year. And in one of the games, not in 1982, but I think it was the year before, and Coach Elway's team was beaten up on his son. And he was kidding. So his son, and so the coach is part of him is happy, because San Jose State is beating down Stanford, but he's getting his son just get beat up on the field, and he got very angry with Stanford coach for keeping John Elway in there, because the coach Elway and John Elway were extraordinarily close.
Jack Elway, who was quite a coach, and of course his influence on his son is evident. I'm looking. He was head coach of Stanford from 1984 to 88, so he did succeed.
Okay.
He did succeed,
right.
Paul Wiggin. Thank you, Tracy, for that note. And I noted a few moments ago that let's turn the clock ahead 9 years to 1991. Tyler Bridges was in Louisiana as a young reporter covering the race between Edwin Edwards and David Ernest Duke. And Edwin Washington Edwards, a few days ago, celebrated the 26th anniversary of his victory, an improbable victory in which Buddy Romer finished third, a man who would have defeated either candidate handsomely in a runoff, but he didn't make the runoff, Tyler.
Yeah, and you remember, Jim, that Buddy switched political parties. He became, I think, the first sitting governor at that point to switch. He became a Republican. And as you said, he finished third in the primary, and it set up what people called the race from hell.
Well, Duke at that time was all of, 41 years old. It looked like that he could be a major player on the national scene, but he flamed out pretty quickly after that.
Yeah, he ran for the Senate in 1996, did fairly well, but nowhere like he had done in the 1990 race against Bennett Johnston. And then he ran for the Congress when Bob Livingston resigned, and finished a third in a race that David Vitter won to go to Congress. And then you'll remember he was caught up in this deal where he had sold his mailing list in the 1995 governor's race to Mike Foster. And that came out in 1999. And that ultimately led to Duke pleading guilty in 2002 to stealing money from his followers to gamble on casinos. Although he would never, even though he pleaded guilty, he later said that he only pleaded guilty because he wouldn't get a fair trial, which I don't think the evidence is true on that. But so he did go to prison. And remember last year when he ran for the Senate, he only got 3%. So, Jim, I'm taking my 1994 book, The Rise of David Duke, and I've written four new chapters of the highlights of what's happened since then, including a final chapter on the events of Charlottesville.
We do have to roll, but we look forward to The Rise and Fall of David Duke from Tyler Bridges, and soon a book about the big game of 1982. Thank you for listening today, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.